diplomats and served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon, some of the most dangerous posts in the world. He retired this past summer after a year as ambassador to Afghanistan and a decade after he reopened the U.S. embassy in Kabul. He's received numerous honors for his work. Ambassador Crocker joins us today on Radio Times to discuss the NATO-U.S. role in Afghanistan, his vision of the future of that country. We'll talk about his time in Iraq and the lessons learned and not learned about military intervention. And in light of the death of Ambassador Christopher Stevens in Benghazi, Libya, I'm also interested in his thoughts about the role and risk faced by U.S. diplomats stationed in conflict zones and how the U.S. is viewed in the Islamic world. Certainly enough for an hour's worth of conversation. Ambassador Crocker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, great to be here. Great to be in Philadelphia.
I should also add that he's a Kissinger Senior Fellow at the Johnson Center for the Study of American Diplomacy at Yale University. You were a diplomat for almost 40 years in, as I said, some of the really hot spot parts of the world. Do you think the world has become a more dangerous place in the last 40 years?
It certainly has become a more complicated place since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The bipolar world that existed from 1945 to 1990 had its horrors, the terror of nuclear war, but it was remarkably stable. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, it didn't become a unipolar world that we led. It became a multipolar or nonpolar world in which regional states that had to look either to Washington or Moscow, no longer needed to do so. So we're seeing, throughout the world, a resurgence of individual forces, agendas, and threats.
You have served in largely Islamic countries. How do you understand the kind of turmoil that we're seeing within the Islamic world?
I don't tend to interpret it as a function of religion. Islam is like Judaism, is like Christianity. It reflects more the history of this region, both in its own terms, but also its interaction with the West. If you look at the whole broad Middle East, from Morocco on the Atlantic in the West all the way through Afghanistan and Pakistan, different ethnicities, different languages, but one thing in common, they've all been occupied by the West.
Under colonial rule, for
absolutely.
Instance.
The modern period of occupation began at the end of the 18th century, 1798, when Napoleon Bonaparte invaded and occupied Egypt. From that time forward, the French, the British, the Italians, the Russians, and the Americans.
Well, I was going to say, do you think we are viewed as occupiers today in this part of the world?
Against the backdrop of their history as they read it and see it, and that goes back to the Crusades, we are seen as part of that trend. It's not how we see ourselves. Oh. We see ourselves as the ultimate anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist nation. Given our own history, that is not how the Middle East sees us.
It's interesting you say that because I was thinking about the speech that President Obama gave shortly after he became president, a speech to the Arab world about the United States. That didn't seem to budge public opinion.
They had heard words before. The reaction that I got was, nice speech. Now walk the walk.
Right.
And by and large, most Middle Easterners would say, we haven't done that.
And what is their definition of walking the walk then?
Active intervention to demonstrate that the Middle East is of true strategic importance to the U.S., that we care what happens in the region and within countries in that region. What they've seen is more of the same, vis-a-vis the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, vis-a-vis our reaction to the Arab Spring, vis-a-vis our dealings with traditional governments, that nothing really changed.
And vis-a-vis the U.S. invasion of Iraq, do you include that as well?
That is with our withdrawal of all of our forces in 2010, that's receding a bit as an issue, in part because of the predominance of the Arab Spring revolutions, but it's still a factor.
I know you were never ambassador to Israel, but certainly you were ambassador to Lebanon, Kuwait, and other countries, neighbors to Israel. But I know there has been an argument, I don't know if it's still true today, that if there could be some kind of resolution, a two-state solution to that conflict, that would help stabilize this world that we've been talking about. Do you think that's still true today?
Well, it certainly would be important in removing a major source of instability that has persisted ever since the creation of the State of Israel. But it would not solve, by any means, all the problems of the region, which, again, have, in many cases, nothing to do with Israel. The Iran-Iraq War, 80 to 88, the most vicious ground conflict since World War I, had nothing to do with Israel. In many cases, sadly, Arab states have used the unresolved situation with Israel as a pretext or an excuse, either for internal repression or for conflict with neighbors.
Let me ask you about Afghanistan. You were the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan until just, I guess, a couple of months ago. How do you assess, I won't even say winning or losing, but I guess progress in that country from an American perspective?
You know, I tend to be cautiously optimistic.
Really?
Not so much from an American assessment, but what Afghans themselves think. The Asia Society, for example, has done polling there since the fall of the Taliban. They're good at it. They do it at least annually. The last poll, which was done in the summer, shows that for the first time, a majority of Afghans think the country is moving in the right direction. They give their government high marks for achievements, particularly in education and health. They like their armed forces. The army has a 90% approval rating. They even like their parliament. 75% of Afghans think their parliament is doing a good job. You're never going to get 75% of Americans to say that about Congress.
How do they feel about Hamid Karzai?
You know, the support for the government, I think, broadly speaking, translates to support for President Karzai.
There's a Pentagon report that came out recently, though, that I think paints a very different picture, that only one of the 23 Afghan National Army brigades can operate independently. The Taliban is adaptive and determined. Of course, there's the killings of the I guess it's blue on
green on blue
killings that we know have been on the rise, certainly this year, as signs that there are, if not problems in Afghanistan, concerns about U.S. relationship with Afghanistan and what could happen or what might happen if and when the U.S. finally withdraws.
Afghanistan is never going to be Switzerland with palm trees. But I think we have to be careful to take these things in context. The Pentagon uses a very stringent measurement when they come to these conclusions. In fact, Afghan units do operate independently during cases such as the inadvertent burning of a number of Qurans that led to riots throughout the country. Coalition forces had to stay in barracks. For us to be involved in trying to put down riots would have just made it worse. So Afghan forces had to deal with that completely on their own. They did. When the Pentagon says one brigade, that means no U.S. advisors, no U.S. logistical support, no U.S. medical support.
Entirely independent.
Entirely independent. So it is true that they're a long way from that. Many, many Afghan units are perfectly capable of carrying the fight on their own as long as we can do their medical evacuations and bring up the ammunition and the food.
The other thing the report says, and I just want to run this by you, which is that violence in Afghanistan is higher than before the surge of 2 years ago. Does that square with your experience?
Absolutely. It's the same thing we saw in Iraq when we surged there. And the reason it's higher is that we're taking a fight to the enemy. Before, they were kind of sitting fat and happy, not engaged, controlling territory. We and the Afghans are now taking that territory from them, so that is inevitably going to escalate violence.
You were the sixth U.S. ambassador to serve in Afghanistan since 2001. I think I did my math correctly. Do you think there's I don't know if it's a problem, but a challenge to have so many U.S. ambassadors in one country over such a short period of time?
I'm not sure about your math, Marty.
Okay. I will check that, or we can Google that. But nonetheless, you served there for a year.
Right. And it would have been longer. I had some health issues that had to be dealt with. But I did have an advantage. I opened our embassy in Kabul after the fall of the Taliban. I got to Afghanistan 10 days after President Karzai arrived from Berlin as chairman of the Afghan Interim Authority. We worked very, very closely together for a number of months until an ambassador was named. So I didn't start from ground zero. I had some knowledge of the country. I knew President Karzai. I knew a number of the leaders. And I also had 3 years in Pakistan, during which I made a number of visits over to Afghanistan. So there are ways of managing continuity other than, long-term physical presence.
What should we know about President Karzai?
Several things. First, he arguably has had the worst job in the world for more than a decade. He survived a number of assassination attempts. He is constantly balancing and rebalancing forces and personalities to keep Afghanistan stable. He is a committed Afghan nationalist in the sense that although he is a member of the majority Pashtun ethnic group, he sees Afghans as Afghans, not as Pashtuns, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and so forth. He is not blind to ethnicity, but he knows he's got to take into account minority concerns. So he's very, very attentive to that, and I think that has been a huge factor in ensuring that these groups look to the center rather than allow a centrifugal movement to take hold that could further divide the country.
The center meaning the central government.
Right. And as we look to the 2014 elections, what we see is all of these groups, again, posturing themselves to do the best they can in central elections. And I think that's extremely important.
Let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Ambassador Ryan Crocker. Again, he has served as U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, which we were just talking about, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers evening art and design studios for adults at their convenient Center City campus. Programs include fashion design, digital photography, jewelry, and certificate programs for career advancement in print and web design, fashion studies, and interior design. The continuing education winter session at Moore College of Art and Design begins Tuesday, January 22nd. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Singer-songwriter Miguel is riding high on a wave of appreciation for his latest album, and that's the approach he takes to writing those hits.
The best comparison would be, to surfing. You never really know how the wave is going to set up. You just kind of ride out there with your board, and you wait for it.
Miguel is with us next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker about his experiences working as an ambassador and some tough posts around the world. Also talking a bit about foreign policy and some of the challenges of being in conflict zones that he and others have faced as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I have a couple more questions about Afghanistan. And I hear you saying about Hamid Karzai that he thinks like an Afghan and doesn't think in some of these sort of tribal terms. Is he a partner? Is he an ally of the United States?
I think he is. One of my missions in Afghanistan was to negotiate a long-term strategic partnership agreement. We did that. He signed it with President Obama in Kabul last May because he wanted it. He wants that strategic relationship. Among other things, we designated Afghanistan as a major non-NATO ally of the United States. Mm-hmm. He very much sees Afghanistan's future, if it is to be a good one, as linked to the West generally and the U.S. in particular. He has had his differences with us, as we have had with him, but fundamentally, and I think I know him pretty well, he wants a strong, enduring relationship with the U.S.
What's your vision after 2014 when at least on U.S. NATO forces supposed to leave, most of them supposed to leave Afghanistan?
Well, I think we're right to draw down. The Afghans are assuming a greater and greater security role. They are now responsible primarily for security of 75% of the population today. But I also think we need to look very carefully at a residual presence, and that's being negotiated right now, past 2014. Because, again, there are some things the Afghans are not going to be able to do for themselves. I talked about a few of those. There are others. They don't have an effective air force, and they've got at least two tough neighbors in Pakistan and Iran. They need some assurance that they're not completely vulnerable to attack by air when they can't defend against it. So, I'm hopeful that these negotiations will lead to a longer-term U.S. presence that will not have us involved in combat. Training, advising, special systems, enablers, logistical support. We've been in Korea for, six decades.
Right.
As long as we are not taking casualties, as long as we're not involved in combat, I'm hopeful that the U.S. people as well as the Afghan people would support an extended role of a much smaller presence.
I was reading some interviews that you've done in the last couple of months. One of them, a comment you made questioning whether the U.S. maybe has done too much in Afghanistan. The problem, I guess, of not doing enough or doing too much. I'm curious about how you weigh those.
Well, we Americans are a great people. This is a great nation. And it became a great nation because we're doers.
That's what we do, right?
Get her done. And that was our mindset in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And we tend to do in foreign places against a backdrop of a pretty profound lack of knowledge of how those societies and cultures really work, what the history has been, and what the people actually want. So in the case of Afghanistan, which is largely rural, which has had its own way of governing its affairs in villages through councils of elders, elections, not what they're looking for at the municipal level. They have their own way of doing this. We may think a road is a great idea into a remote village because farm-to-market transportation. Well, it also opens up that village to access to elements that may be hostile or unwelcome in that village. As they say in medical school, first do no harm. And that means figuring out what people really want, why they want it, how it can be sustained, because we have built monuments to folly in both Afghanistan and Iraq in the sense of sophisticated installations that they are not able to maintain. Just get it right, respect local tradition, be sure that your effort at modernization actually matches what the people want. And I think in both Iraq and Afghanistan, sometimes we've just gone over that line.
Well, we left when the Soviets arrived. We left to go fight the Iraq war. Looks like we're going to largely leave in a year or so.
Yeah, certainly my counsel would be that we not do that. That is why, at the president's direction, I negotiated that strategic partnership agreement that commits us as allies through 2024. Right. There's a whole framework in place, bilaterally through that agreement and two associated memoranda of understandings on how special operations and detentions will be conducted by the Afghans, and a set of international agreements. The Chicago summit in May resulted in pledges from the international community to support a substantial Afghan security force in the out years, well beyond 2014. The Tokyo ministerial in July was the economic counterpart, a long-term commitment to economic assistance to Afghanistan. It's going to require U.S. leadership. And U.S. money. In the case of the Afghan military, it would cost the U.S. approximately $2.5 billion a year, which is a lot of money, until you compare it to the $110 billion a year that we're spending right now.
Right. On having such a large military force
right
there.
So it's a pretty cheap insurance policy, given that 9/11 came from Afghanistan.
And for Americans who were either war-weary or frustrated with Afghanistan or critics of our policy there, what do you say to them?
What I just said, don't forget where 9/11 came from. And the people who brought us 9/11 want the country back. The Taliban,
Al-Qaeda,
with Al-Qaeda
such
behind
as
them. And Al-Qaeda, such as it is pretty formidable. They've been badly weakened in the border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but they are pretty darn strong in North Africa, in Yemen, and elsewhere. If they can come back to Afghanistan, that's where they're coming. And we will have a pre-9/11 situation all over again. It's worth remembering. For people who are tired of all of this. And believe me, I'm plenty tired. I spent 7 years between Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The recommendation of the final 9/11 Commission report is that the United States support the establishment of a stable and secure Afghan state so that the conditions can never again arise where American soil can be struck from enemies within Afghanistan. We would be wise to carry out that recommendation.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Ambassador Ryan Crocker, and he has served as a U.S. ambassador to six countries around the world, six countries often in conflict, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon, and joins us today in Radio Times to talk about a bit about his career and also his perspective on U.S. foreign policy in the world that we live in. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to talk about Libya and Ambassador Stevens. Did you know him as a fellow ambassador?
I knew him almost from the time he joined the Foreign Service.
Really?
Back in 1991. The Near East Bureau and those who populated in the State Department, we are a pretty small tribe. We all know each other. So I knew and respected him for basically two decades.
It seems like, at least for those of us that didn't know him, what a loss. But I'm assuming people that knew him, an even bigger loss.
Yeah, a huge loss. No American diplomat knew Libya better than Chris Stevens. Fluent Arabic speaker. He spent 2 years as emissary to the Libyan opposition before he became ambassador. He was known and trusted by the Libyans. He was in Benghazi because Benghazi is the center. Tripoli may be the capital, but Benghazi is where the revolution started. Right. He he knew where he needed to be and who he needed to talk to, and that's what diplomacy is all about.
His death, of course, and the death of others along with him have raised questions about how much do we protect our ambassadors or our diplomats? Should we build, you know, more thicker, taller walls? Should there be more security? What are your thoughts? And you, I know you have been in some pretty explosive situations yourself.
Well, I think secure installations are important. The embassy in Kabul is a pretty secure installation. I'm grateful for that because it was attacked twice when I was there. We were able to beat that back without loss of American life. But we also, if we're going to be effective, we've got to be out with the people. We've got to know who the players are and what the games are they are playing, which means we have to take risks. We've got to take chances. We're the foreign service. Foreign because we're the most expeditionary of all services. 75% of us are abroad any given day. Service in the sense that the military is a service. We swear the same oath that our brothers and sisters in uniform swear. And to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That doesn't mean exclusively in the cafes of Brussels or the restaurants of Paris. It means in the hard places of the world. We have to be prepared to take risks. And we and the American people and the American Congress have to be prepared to accept that we will have losses occasionally. You know, we can't have a zero defect policy. You know, we lose, sadly, service members every single day. Well, you know, we're in the same fight they are. If, you know, we're not out doing what we're doing or should be doing, their losses will go up. And U.S. national interests will suffer. Let me put it this way.
Okay.
I was an ambassador six times, as you pointed out. In three of those six posts, a predecessor of mine as ambassador was assassinated in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. It's not a new phenomenon, sadly. More ambassadors have been killed in the line of duty since the end of World War II than general officers in the military. It goes with the job. And the last thing that I would want to see, and I know it's the last thing Chris Stevens would want to see, is a retrenchment to say we're going to be less engaged, less involved. We blind ourselves to a tumultuous region in the Middle East and we'll pay a great price in national security.
But would it be fair to say that he knew these dangers, and it was clear reading about him is that he was very comfortable and wanted to be out among the people, walking the streets, being seen outside of the embassy or outside of the, you know, a U.S. building?
Absolutely. He definitely knew the risks. He also understood the importance of being visible as ambassador and engaged with the people. I did the same thing in Iraq. You know, I was a little bit luckier. You can do, my motto, as it is for many of us, is you can do anything once. If they don't know you're coming, they can't set up to hit you. So, like in Baghdad, I just decided on the spur of the moment, let's go over to Dora District and see how the market's doing. And, you know, we'd whip in there with, you know, no notice. By the time someone was ready to take offense at that, we were gone.
You were in Beirut. This was 1983 when the U.S. barracks, or I guess the U.S. embassy was attacked. Mm-hmm. Something like 63 people were killed, including 17 Americans. You were, I read, you were one of the first people on the scene.
I was in the building.
You were in the building, yes.
Yeah, when it blew up. Yeah, it was the worst loss of American diplomatic life in our diplomatic history. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, of course, the Marine barracks were bombed with the loss of over 240 Marines and sailors. You know, bad time, dangerous place. That's why I'm a strong believer in fortified facilities, but freedom to move outside those facilities.
Also, as ambassador to Syria, the embassy was attacked, right?
Twice when I was there.
Right.
My residence was attacked and overrun once. Again, it's a tough neighborhood.
What do you make of? And there, were, of course, with the Benghazi attack and the four deaths of four Americans, we were very aware of Congress debating, and that we were, of course, in the middle of a presidential campaign. There was a lot of finger pointing. What did you make of that discussion about what happened in Benghazi?
In a word, appalling.
Really?
Frankly, on the part of both the administration and Congress. The administration stuck to a version of events long after it was clear that that was an incorrect version.
These were al-Qaeda-related terrorists,
right? Yeah,
that had attacked
that it wasn't simply a crowd that got out of control. So it gave the appearance of, you know, some kind of cover-up. I don't think that was their intention. I think it was more ineptitude than anything, but it wasn't good. And then Congress simply tried to make political hay out of it. I hope we just take a deep breath, try to understand and remember what it is diplomats do and why they do it. We are really the front line for national security. If we're able to do our jobs and do our jobs right, we can forestall situations or redirect forces so that you don't have to send in the military. But you got to let us do it.
Did you testify before Congress? Were you asked to testify at all?
Not on the Benghazi incident.
No. I mean, would you have wanted to?
Well, I've had the chance through programs such as this to make my views pretty clear, so I...
Well, I'm not a member of Congress. but it shows, I guess, when politics intrudes itself or gets wrapped up in policy or diplomacy.
Well, look, this is America. We're a democracy. You can never separate politics from policy, nor really should you try. That can get dangerous. We are a professional service, as the military are professional services. We don't make policies. That is done at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue in the White House and resourced at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue on the Hill, which provides the resources. That's the way it should be. But again, you know, we've got to be careful not to go to extremes and, understand that we're all trying to serve a national interest. Let's concentrate on that, particularly in incidents such as Benghazi.
Mm. We're almost up in a break here, but do you miss being U.S. ambassador or being a diplomat?
Well, again, I did it for almost 40 years. I was an ambassador since 1990. I retired once after I was ambassador to Iraq in 2009, was recalled to service by President Obama. As my friends put it, I have succeeded in a number of things, but I seem to fail retirement. So I'm trying it again.
Fair enough. Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We also have some callers who want to join us as well. And again, our guest is Ambassador Ryan Crocker. Served, and I should just say this only because these are quite extraordinary posts that he had, U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
That special time is coming. The kids are on their best.
On the next Fresh Air, guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli talks about his musical family, what it was like opening for Sinatra on an international tour, and he performs holiday songs with his brother Martin on bass. Join us.
For Santa Claus is near. Here comes Santa.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A journalist crunches the numbers and decides for now not to have a child because it's too expensive, $1.7 million. There are questions about that amount and her decision. We'll ask them. Also, The Hobbit goes from page to screen. We'll ask a Tolkien scholar, does anything get lost in the translation? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He's also a Kissinger Senior Fellow at the Johnson Center for the Study of American Diplomacy at Yale University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have done entire shows about the Iraq War, but because you served as U.S. Ambassador and also worked with General David Petraeus, I just have a couple of questions about that as well. I guess question about the unintended consequences of that particular war. And what do you see as the unintended consequences?
Well, it's a point I made actually before we went into Iraq.
Right.
Be careful what you get into, because invading another country has not just second and third order consequences, it has 30th and 40th order consequences that you can never predict. The Bush administration was criticized, rightly I think, for not having appropriately planned for the aftermath. But the truth is, no amount of planning would have prepared us for, you know, the totality of what we encountered over the years. Again, you have to make a very sober, cold judgment, is not only risk versus gain, but how much unknown risk are you ready to absorb?
And that's, of course, the sectarian ethnic violence, the civil war that erupted in that country as well. As you look at Iraq today, is it better off without Saddam Hussein?
You know, I think it is. The sectarian violence was horrible and raging when Dave Petraeus and I arrived in early 07. But it's also an anomaly in Iraq. The last time you saw serious sectarian violence was the beginning of the 19th century, about 1804.
So that had that just been under, you know, sort of underground all those years?
No. It took an outside precipitator, in this case Al-Qaeda, coming out of Syria, that in many cases coerced Iraqi Sunni elements into supporting them, and then attacked Shia, who formed their own militias with Iranian backing, and the fight was on. And remember how it ended with the so-called awakening that General John Allen, now commander in Afghanistan, was the primary architect of from the American side out in western Anbar, in which Sunni Iraqis had enough of al-Qaeda. They turned against them as long as they knew we had their backs. And once the Shia saw that that the Sunnis who were fighting them last week are now fighting a common enemy, took a look at the militias behind them and said, we don't like these guys. Huh. And, you know, the conflict came to an end. I don't think it's likely to restart.
I ran across one of your quotes, Iraq is Iraq, the toughest sons of bitches on the block. Do you stand by those words?
Depends on how you define the block. If you're going to include Philadelphia, it might be up for debate. But
It's a tough town.
Tough town. You know, I've been to an Eagles game, so.
But still, I think it's an interest. I mean, it was an interesting quote. I wrote it down.
Well, it's telling too. You know, Iraqis are Iraqis, whoever's governing them, you know, ask their neighbors. You know, they are a formidable foe. And an absolutely invaluable ally, because they don't run from anything.
What's your relationship with General David Petraeus?
You know, there is no finer soldier that I know who's worn the uniform. We connected before either of us ever got to Iraq. I was still in Pakistan as ambassador. He was at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, and we got on a secure line and said, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And we figured it out immediately that While a close partnership between us might not guarantee success, the absence of that partnership would certainly guarantee failure. So we were teammates right from the beginning. We formed a joint strategic assessment team, half civilian, half military, two leaders, one Foreign Service officer, one Army officer, to map out a campaign plan. And everything we did together. He had infallible political judgment, as well as being one of the finest military commanders we ever had. We did our meetings together. We would switch seats with the prime minister, depending on whose agenda item, you know, was foremost.
This was in Iraq.
Was in Iraq, yeah. Right. And a great officer, a great man, and a great friend.
Should he have resigned after it was revealed he was having or had had an affair with his biographer?
Well, that clearly was his choice. My personal view is his departure from public life as director of Central Intelligence is a loss to the nation.
Yeah. But I guess, in fact, you and I were talking about this before we went on the air. The idea, I mean, these are yourself included, public officials, public people with private lives. How do we, should we insert a kind of wall there?
Well, look, I think we could do with a little less focus on private lives that do not affect or touch on official performance. 'Cause we're killing our own in many cases. We're setting a standard that a private American would never be expected to meet. Dave, like me, like John Allen in Afghanistan, we've been in this fight for a long time, mm-hmm. 6-7 years. It takes its toll. I think we're too quick to rush to judgment on issues or incidents that really don't touch on official duties.
What's the toll on you? And I know that you left Afghanistan for health reasons. What was the toll on you?
Major brain surgery in October.
Really? So yeah. You had a tumor or what was the problem?
It was a subdural hematoma, blood on the brain, that was just about to produce a stroke.
So it was diagnosed early?
When I couldn't walk, stand up, or do anything else, I was taken to the hospital and they did surgery immediately. So.
Do you think that was in any way stress-related? I mean, you spent almost 40 years as a diplomat.
Well, the docs do. This condition can be caused by trauma to the head. That didn't happen to me. In most cases, unknown causes. It happens.
Yeah.
I got a good surgeon, and here I am.
How do you feel? I mean, any side effects from it, or...?
Listen, I just got back from a 10-day trip to Vietnam, I'm doing great.
Let me ask you about something I was reading about, and you don't have to answer this or not, but I was also reading that in the summer you were arrested for what appeared to be a drunk driving incident. Is that in any way related to your brain surgery, or was that just a momentary lapse on your part?
It was eventually adjudicated as reckless driving.
Right.
But I take full responsibility for it. I mean, it's
something you did, and it happened, and
I'm not blaming anybody or anything except myself.
Right. That must have been a difficult situation for you.
Yeah, I'd just been back 10 days from Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and again, lapse of judgment for which there is no acceptable excuse.
That's Ambassador Ryan Crocker, our guest today on Radio Times. And I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what Anders from South Philadelphia has to say. Anders, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good afternoon. My question is, it's a little multifaceted. It seems to me that NATO is becoming increasingly more important with regards to the implementation of Middle Eastern policy, especially with Turkey's membership. Mm-hmm. My question is, while I understand that many members of the European Union and the Eurozone itself are not NATO members, to what extent has the Eurozone crisis affected our ability to implement effective Middle Eastern policy? And secondly, what would the fracturing of the European Union, such as the so-called Brexit, the British exit of the European Union, how would that possibly affect our future ability to implement policy in the region?
It's a good question, Anders. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Ambassador Cocker, go ahead.
It is a good question, Anders. The predominant vehicle that we have used for coordinated action in the Middle East has been NATO. And NATO is rock solid, as it has shown in Libya, as it has shown in Afghanistan. So the European Union, of course, is an important partner. I am more concerned about the economic consequences of a Eurozone meltdown than I am over foreign policy coordination, because we have other vehicles to accomplish that, both multilateral, again, NATO, as well as bilateral. So I would not see a further degradation of the European Union as directly or dramatically influencing negatively our ability to carry forward policy initiatives in the Middle East. It would have other consequences because we are by no means immune economically in America to what happens economically in Europe.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Let's see what Sarah from Bryn Mawr has to say. Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'd like to thank Ambassador Crocker for his very distinguished service. My question is, what can members of the public do to support the work of the Foreign Service in addition to informing ourselves?
Well,
thank you, Sarah. Yeah, go ahead, Ambassador.
Thanks, Sarah, both for your compliment and your interest in the Foreign Service. The most important thing, I think, that Americans can do to support the Foreign Service is to make an issue out of that with their elected representatives. The Foreign Service, because, again, we are the Foreign Service. We don't really have a constituency back here other than interested and concerned citizens who follow international affairs. So, you know, writing your congressman, writing your senator, making it clear that you consider the Foreign Service important, that you're aware it is badly understaffed and underfunded, which we are. We don't have nearly enough diplomats to do the jobs we should be doing, is probably the most effective step you can take. The other thing you can do, I'll be speaking to the Philadelphia World Affairs Council after this, support your local World Affairs Councils. You've got a great one here in Philadelphia. And there are 95 councils across the country. They are the leading grassroots organization that translates international issues, American policies, to the American public. They are completely independent of the government, but have been an effective advocate, including the Philadelphia Council, for a stronger Foreign Service.
Sarah, thanks for your call to Radio Times. And we often piggyback off of some of the guests that the World Affairs Council brings into Philadelphia, including you, Ambassador. Let me ask you about Syria. You were an ambassador there. President Obama has recognized the rebels, or this rebel force, as a legitimate representative of the Syrian people. I also was reading the New York Times that there's some concern about al-Qaeda's presence in Syria. What advice do you have for what the U.S. should do in this country?
Well, this takes us back to something we talked about previously, which is the role of diplomats in conflict areas. You know, the first thing you have to do to deal intelligently with a complex and volatile situation is understand it. We don't have people on the ground in Syria. We should. If we have recognized a national coalition, then we should be in there with them.
And know who they are, right?
And exactly. It is as I see it, it is neither national nor a coalition. It is a disparate grouping of factions and groups that are often at odds with each other. And in many cases, we don't know what their agenda is, what their aims are, who backs them, or much about them. The only way you learn that is being on the ground. you know, I hope the administration will take the decision to send some diplomats into Syria, because a lot of Foreign Service hands will go up in a heartbeat to have that opportunity, and we need it.
And advice about Iran's, I mean, same advice, which is that we should have people on the ground in Iran?
Well, we'd have to fight our way in.
Well, I understand that. Right. It sounds like we're wanted there, but nonetheless, is that a missing piece of that puzzle?
Well, Iran is very much engaged in what goes on in Syria, because Syria, under the Assads, has been Iran's only Arab ally since the 79 revolution. So the Iranians are stoutly backing the survival of the Assad regime, as they back the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. So they're all in on this. We are seen a little bit as a fence sitter, even after the recognition. What does it mean? You know, we need to be engaged with our allies in the region, and engaged with the members of the National Coalition.
Well, on that note, Ambassador Crocker, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And our guest has been Ambassador Ryan Crocker, served as U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. And he is on his way, almost as soon as this hour is over, to head out to the World Affairs Council for an event in Radnor outside of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Here and Now. Tomorrow